Island in 1922 among Italian and Portuguese workers failed. But class feelings were awakened, and some of the strikers joined radical movements. Luigi Nardella recalled, "My oldest brother, Guido, he started the strike. Guido pulled the handles on the looms in the Royal Mills, going from one section to the next, shouting, 'Strike! Strike!' When the strike started, we didn't have any union organizers. We got together a group of girls and went from mill to mill, and that morning we got 5 mills out. We'd motion to the girls in the mills, 'Come out! Come out!' Then we'd go on to the next. Somebody from the Young Workers League came out to bring a check and invited me to a meeting, and I went. Then I joined, and in a few years I was in the Risorgimento Club in Providence. We were anti-fascists. I spoke on street corners, bring a stand, jump up and talk to good crowds, and we led the support for Sacco and Vanzetti." After the war, with the Socialist Party weakened, a Communist Party was organized, and Communists were involved in the organization of the Trade Union Education League, which tried to build a militant spirit inside the AFL. When a Communist named Ben Gold of the Furrier section of the TUEL challenged the AFL union leadership at a meeting, he was knifed and beaten. But in 1926, he and other Communists organized a strike of furriers who formed mass picket lines, battled the police to hold their lines, were arrested and beaten, but kept striking until they won a 40-hour week and a wage increase. Communists again played a leading part in the great textile strike that spread through the Carolinas and Tennessee in the spring of 1929. The mill owners had moved to the South to escape unions, to find more subservient workers among the poor whites. But these workers rebelled against the long hours, the low pay. They particularly resented the stretch-out and intensification of work. For instance, a weaver who had operated 24 looms and got $18.91 a week would be raised to $23, but he would be stretched out to 100 looms and had to work at a punishing pace. The first of the textile strikes was in Tennessee, where 500 women in one mill walked out in protest against wages of $9 to $10 a week. Then at Gastonia, North Carolina, workers joined a new union, the National Textile Workers Union, led by Communists, which admitted both blacks and whites to membership. When some of them were fired, half of the 2,000 workers went out on strike. An atmosphere of anti-communism and racism built up, and violence began. Textile strikes began to spread across South Carolina. One by one, the various strikes were settled, with some gains, but not at Gastonia. There, with the textile workers living in a tent colony and refusing to renounce the communists and their leadership, the strike went on. But strike breakers were brought in and the mills kept operating. Desperation grew. There were violent clashes with the police. One dark night, the chief of police was killed in a gun battle, and 16 strikers and sympathizers were indicted for murder, including Fred Beale, a Communist Party organizer. Ultimately, 7 were tried and given sentences of from 5 to 20 years. They were released on bail and left the state. The Communists escaped to Soviet Russia. Through all the defeats, the beatings, the murders, it was the beginning of textile mill unionism in the South. The stock market crash of 1929, which marked the beginning of the Great Depression of the United States, came directly from wild speculation which collapsed and brought the whole economy down with it. But, as John Galbraith says in his study of that event, the Great Crash, behind that speculation was the fact that the economy was fundamentally unsound. He points to very unhealthy corporate and banking structures, an unsound foreign trade, much economic misinformation, and the bad distribution of income. The highest 5% of the population received about 1/3 of all personal income. A socialist critic would go further and say that the capitalist system was by its nature unsound, a system driven by the one overriding motive of corporate profit, and therefore unstable, unpredictable, and blind to human needs. The result of all that, permanent depression for many of its people, and periodic crises for almost everybody. Capitalism, despite its attempts at self-reform, its organization for better control, was still, in 1929, a sick and undependable system. After the crash, the economy was stunned, barely moving. Over 5,000 banks closed and huge numbers of businesses, unable to get money, closed too. Those that continued laid off employees and cut the wages of those who remained again and again. Industrial production fell by 50%, and by 1933, perhaps 15 million, no one knew exactly, one-fourth or one-third of the labor force, were out of work. The Ford Motor Company, which in the spring of 1929 had employed 128,000 workers, was down to 37,000 by August of 1931. By the end of 1930, almost half the 280,000 textile mill workers in New England were out of work. Former President Calvin Coolidge commented with his customary wisdom, "When more and more people are thrown out of work, unemployment results." He spoke again in 1931, "This country is not in good condition." Clearly, those responsible for organizing the economy did not know what had happened, were baffled by it, refused to recognize it, and found reasons other than the failure of the system. Herbert Hoover had said not long before the crash, "We in America today are nearer to the final triumph over poverty than ever before in the history of any land." Henry Ford, in March 1931, said the crisis was here because "The average man won't really do a day's work unless he is caught and cannot get out of it. There's plenty of work to do if people would do it." A few weeks later, he laid off 75,000 workers. There were millions of tons of food around, but it was not profitable to transport it, to sell it. Warehouses were full of clothing, but people could not afford it. There were lots of houses, but they stayed empty because people couldn't pay the rent, had been evicted, and now lived in shacks in quickly formed Hoovervilles built on garbage dumps. Brief glimpses of reality in the newspapers could have been multiplied by the millions. A New York Times story in early 1932. After vainly trying to get a stay of dispossession until January 15th from his apartment at 46 Hancock Street in Brooklyn yesterday, Peter J. Cornell, 48 years old, a former roofing contractor, out of work and penniless, fell dead in the arms of his wife. A doctor gave the cause of his death as heart disease, and the police said it had at least partly been caused by the bitter disappointment of a long day's fruitless attempt to prevent himself and his family being put out on the street. Cornell owed $5 in rent in arrears and $39 for January, which his landlord required in advance. Failure to produce the money resulted in a dispossess order being served on the family yesterday and to take effect at the end of the week. After vainly seeking assistance elsewhere, he was told during the day by the Home Relief Bureau that it would have no funds with which to help him until January 15th. A dispatch from Wisconsin to the Nation in late 1932. "Throughout the Middle West, the tension between the farmers and authorities has been growing as a result of tax and foreclosure sales. In many cases, evictions have been prevented only by mass action on the part of the farmers. However, until the Sechon homestead near Elkhorn, Wisconsin was besieged on December 6 by a host of deputy sheriffs armed with machine guns, rifles, shotguns, and tear gas bombs, there had been no actual violence. Max Sechon's property was auctioned off at a foreclosure sale last August, but he refused to allow either the buyer or the authorities to approach his home. He held off unwelcome visitors with a shotgun. The sheriff called upon Sechon to submit peacefully. When he refused to do so, the sheriff ordered deputies to lay down a barrage of machine gun and rifle fire. Sishon is now in jail in Elkhorn, and his wife and two children who were with him in the house are being cared for in the county hospital. Sishon is not a troublemaker. He enjoys the confidence of his neighbors, who only recently elected him Justice of the Peace of the town of Sugar Creek. That a man of his standing and disposition should go to such lengths in defying the authorities is a clear warning that we may expect further trouble in the agricultural districts unless the farmers are soon helped. A tenement dweller on 113th Street in East Harlem wrote to Congressman Fiorello LaGuardia in Washington, "You know, my condition is bad. I used to get pension from the government and they stopped. It is now nearly 7 months I am out of work. I hope you will try to do something for me. I have four children who are in need of clothes and food. My daughter, who is 8, is very ill and not recovering. My rent is due 2 months, and I am afraid of being put out." In Oklahoma, the farmers found their farms sold under the auctioneer's hammer, their farms turning to dust, the tractors coming in and taking over. John Steinbeck, in his novel of the Depression, The Grapes of Wrath, describes what happened. "And the dispossessed, the migrants, flowed into California, 250,000 and 300,000. Behind them, new tractors were going on the land and the tenants were being forced off. And new waves were on the way, new waves of the dispossessed and the homeless, hard, intent, and dangerous. And a homeless, hungry man, driving the road with his wife beside him and his thin children in the back seat, could look at the fallow fields which might produce food but not profit, and that man could know how a fallow field is a sin, and the unused land a crime against the thin children. And in the south he saw the golden oranges hanging on the trees, the little golden oranges on the dark green trees, and guards with shotguns patrolling the lines, so a man might not pick an orange for a thin child, oranges to be dumped if the price was low." These people were becoming dangerous, as Steinbeck said. The spirit of rebellion was growing. Moritz Hallgren, in a 1933 book, Seeds of Revolt, compiled newspaper reports of things happening around the country. England, Arkansas, January 3, 1931. The long drought that ruined hundreds of Arkansas farms last summer had a dramatic sequel late today when some 500 farmers, most of them white men, and many of them armed, marched on the business section of this town, shouting that they must have food for themselves and their families. The invaders announced their intention to take it from the stores unless it were provided from some other source without cost. Detroit, July 9, 1931. An incipient riot by 500 unemployed men, turned out of the city lodging house for lack of funds, was quelled by police reserves in Cadillac Square tonight. Indiana Harbor, Indiana, August 5, 1931. 1,500 jobless men stormed the plant of the Fruit Growers Express Company here, demanding that they be given jobs to keep from starving. The company's answer was to call the city police, who routed the jobless with menacing clubs. Boston, November 10, 1931. 20 persons were treated for injuries. 3 were hurt so seriously that they may die, and dozens of others were nursing wounds from flying bottles, lead pipe, and stones after clashes between striking longshoremen and Negro strikebreakers along the Charlestown-East Boston waterfront. Detroit, November 28, 1931. A mounted patrolman was hit on the head with a stone and unhorsed, and one demonstrator was arrested during a disturbance in Grand Circus Park this morning when 2,000 men and women met there in defiance of police orders. Chicago, April 1, 1932. 500 schoolchildren, most with haggard faces and in tattered clothes, paraded through Chicago's downtown section to the Board of Education offices to demand that the school system provide them with food. Boston, June 3, 1932. 25 hungry children raided a buffet lunch set up for Spanish War veterans during a Boston parade. 2 automobile loads of police were called in to drive them away. New York, January 21, 1933. Several hundred jobless surrounded a restaurant just off Union Square today, demanding they be fed without charge. Seattle, February 16, 1933. A two-day siege of the County City Building, occupied by an army of about 5,000 unemployed, was ended early tonight. Deputy sheriffs and police evicting the demonstrators after nearly 2 hours of efforts. Yip Harburg, the songwriter, told Studs Terkel about the year 1932. I was walking along the street at that time, and you'd see the bread lines. The biggest one in New York City was owned by William Randolph Hearst. He had a big truck with several people on it, and big cauldrons of hot soup, bread. Fellas with burlap on their feet were lined up all around Columbus Circle and went for blocks and blocks around the park waiting. Harburg had to write a song for the show Americana. He wrote, "Brother, can you spare a dime?" Once in khaki suits, gee, we looked swell, full of that Yankee doodly-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell. I was the kid with the drum. "Say, don't you remember, they called me Al. It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember, I'm your pal. Brother, can you spare a dime?" It was not just a song of despair, as Yip Harburg told Terkel. In the song, the man is really saying, "I made an investment in this country. Where the hell are my dividends?" It's more than just a bit of pathos. It doesn't reduce him to a beggar. It makes him a dignified human, asking questions, and a bit outraged, too, as he should be. The anger of the veteran of the First World War, now without work, his family hungry, led to the march of the Bonus Army to Washington in the spring and summer of 1932. War veterans, holding government bonus certificates which were due years in the future, demanded that Congress pay off on them now, when the money was desperately needed. And so they began to move to Washington from all over the country, with wives and children or alone. They came in broken-down old autos, stealing rides on freight trains or hitchhiking. They were miners from West Virginia, sheet metal workers from Columbus, Georgia, and unemployed Polish veterans from Chicago. One family, husband, wife, three-year-old boy, spent 3 months on freight trains coming from California. Chief Running Wolf, a jobless Mescalero Indian from New Mexico, showed up in full Indian dress with bow and arrow. More than 20,000 came. Most camped across the Potomac River from the Capitol on Anacostia Flats, where, as John Dos Passos wrote, "The men are sleeping in little lean-tos built out of old newspapers, cardboard boxes, packing crates, bits of tin or tar paper roofing, every kind of cockeyed makeshift shelter from the rain scrapped together out of the city dump." The bill to pay off on the bonus passed the House, but was defeated in the Senate. And some veterans, discouraged, left. Most stayed, some encamped in government buildings near the Capitol, the rest on Anacostia Flats, and President Hoover ordered the Army to evict them. 4 troops of cavalry, 4 companies of infantry, a machine gun squadron, and 6 tanks assembled near the White House. General Douglas MacArthur was in charge of the operation, Major Dwight Eisenhower his aide. George S. Patton was one of the officers. MacArthur led his troops down Pennsylvania Avenue, used tear gas to clear veterans out of the old buildings, and set the buildings on fire. Then the army moved across the bridge to Anacostia. Thousands of veterans, wives, children, began to run as the tear gas spread. The soldiers set fire to some of the huts, and soon the whole encampment was ablaze. When it was all over, 2 veterans had been shot to death, an 11-week-old baby had died, an 8-year-old boy was partially blinded by gas, 2 police had fractured skulls, and 1,000 veterans were injured by gas. The hard, hard times, the inaction of the government in helping, the action of the government in dispersing war veterans, all had their effect on the election of November 1932. Democratic Party candidate Franklin D. Roosevelt defeated Herbert Hoover overwhelmingly, took office in the spring of 1933, and began a program of reform legislation, which became famous as the New Deal. When a small veterans' march on Washington took place early in his administration, he greeted them and provided coffee. They met with one of his aides and went home. It was a sign of Roosevelt's approach. The Roosevelt reforms went far beyond previous legislation. They had to meet two pressing needs: to reorganize capitalism in such a way to overcome the crisis and stabilize the system, also to head off the alarming growth of spontaneous rebellion in the early years of the Roosevelt administration, organization of tenants and the unemployed, movements of self-help, general strikes in several cities. That first objective, to stabilize the system for its own protection, was most obvious in the major law of Roosevelt's first months in office, the National Recovery Act, NRA. It was designed to take control of the economy through a series of codes agreed on by management, labor, and the government, fixing prices and wages, limiting competition. From the first, the NRA was dominated by big business and served their interests. As Bernard Bellish says, the failure of the NRA, its Title I turned much of the nation's power over to highly organized, well-financed trade associations and industrial combines. The unorganized public, otherwise known as the consumer, along with the members of the fledgling trade union movement, had virtually nothing to say about the initial organization of the National Recovery Administration or the formulation of basic policy. Where organized labor was strong, Roosevelt moved to make some concessions to working people. But where organized labor was weak, Roosevelt was unprepared to withstand the pressures of industrial spokesmen to control the NRA codes. Barton Bernstein, Towards a New Past, confirms this. Despite the annoyance of some big businessmen with Section 7A, the NRA reaffirmed and consolidated their power. Bellish sums up his view of the NRA. The White House permitted the National Association of Manufacturers, the Chamber of Commerce, and allied business and trade associations to assume overriding authority. Indeed, private administration became public administration, and private government became public government, ensuring the marriage of capitalism with statism. When the Supreme Court in 1935 declared the NRA unconstitutional, it claimed it gave too much power to the president. But according to Bellish, FDR surrendered an inordinate share of the power of government through the NRA to industrial spokesmen throughout the country. Also passed in the first months of the new administration, the AAA, Agricultural Adjustment Administration, was an attempt to organize agriculture. It favored the larger farmers as the NRA favored big business. The TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority, was an unusual entrance of government into business, a government-owned network of dams and hydroelectric plants to control floods and produce electric power in the Tennessee Valley. It gave jobs to the unemployed, helped the consumer with lower electric rates, and in some respect deserved the accusation that it was socialistic. But the New Deal's organization of the economy was aimed mainly at stabilizing the economy and secondly at giving enough help to the lower classes to keep them from turning a rebellion into a real revolution. That rebellion was real when Roosevelt took office. Desperate people were not waiting for the government to help them. They were helping themselves, acting directly. Aunt Molly Jackson, a woman who later became active in labor struggles in Appalachia, recalled how she walked into the local store, asked for a 24-pound sack of flour, gave it to her little boy to take it outside, then filled a sack of sugar, and said to the storekeeper, "Well, I'll see you in 90 days. I have to feed some children. I'll pay you. Don't worry." And when he objected, she pulled out her pistol, which, as a midwife traveling alone through the hills, she had a permit to carry, and said, "Martin, if you try to take this grub away from me, God knows that if they electrocute me for it tomorrow, I'll shoot you 6 times in a minute." Then, as she recalls, "I walked out, I got home, and these 7 children were so hungry that they was a-grabbing the raw dough off of their mother's hands and cramming it into their mouths and swallowing it whole." All over the country, people organized spontaneously to stop evictions. In New York, in Chicago, in other cities, when word spread that someone was being evicted, a crowd would gather. The police would remove the furniture from the house, put it out in the street, and the crowd would bring the furniture back. The Communist Party was active in organizing workers' alliance groups in the city. Mrs. Willi Jeffries, a black woman, told Studs Terkel about evictions. "A lot of them was put out. They'd call and have the bailiffs come and sit them out, and as soon as they'd leave, we would put them back where they came out. All we had to do was call Brother Hilton. 'Look, such and such and such a place, there's a family sitting out there.' Everybody passed through the neighborhood was a member of the Workers' Alliance, had one person they would call. When that person would come, he'd have about 50 people with him. Take that stuff right on back up there. The men would connect those lights and go to the hardware and get gas pipe and connect that stove back. Put the furniture back just like you had it so it don't look like you've been out the door." Unemployed councils were formed all over the country. They were described by Charles R. Walker, writing in The Forum in 1932. "I find it is no secret that communists organize unemployed councils in most cities and usually lead them, but the councils are organized democratically and the majority rules. In one I visited at Lincoln Park, Michigan, there were 300 members, of which 11 were communists. The council had a right wing, a left wing, and a center. The chairman of the council was also the local commander of the American Legion. In Chicago, there were 45 branches of the Unemployed Council, with a total membership of 22,000. The council's weapon is democratic force of numbers, and their function is to prevent evictions of the destitute, or, if evicted, to bring pressure to bear on the Relief Commission to find a new home. If an unemployed worker has his gas or his water turned off because he can't pay for it, to see the proper authorities, to see that the unemployed who are shoeless and clothesless get both, to eliminate through publicity and pressure discriminations between Negroes and white persons, or against the foreign-born in matters of relief, to march people down to relief headquarters and demand that they be fed and clothed, finally, to provide legal defense for all unemployed arrested for joining parades, hunger marches, or attending union meetings." People organized to help themselves, since business and government were not helping them in 1931 and 1932. In Seattle, the Fishermen's Union caught fish and exchanged them with people who picked fruit and vegetables, and those who cut wood exchanged that. There were 22 locals, each with a commissary where food and firewood were exchanged for other goods and services. Barbers, seamstresses, and doctors gave of their skills in return for other things. By the end of 1932, there were 330 self-help organizations in 37 states, with over 300,000 members. By early 1933, they seemed to have collapsed. They were attempting too big a job in an economy that was more and more a shambles. Perhaps the most remarkable example of self-help took place in the coal district of Pennsylvania, where teams of unemployed miners dug small mines on company property, mined coal, trucked it to cities, and sold it below the commercial rate. By 1934, 5 million tons of this bootleg coal were produced by 20,000 men using 4,000 vehicles. When attempts were made to prosecute, local juries would not convict. Local jailers would not imprison. These were simple actions taken out of practical need, but they had revolutionary possibilities. Paul Maddock, a Marxist writer, commented, "All that is really necessary for the workers to do in order to end their miseries is to perform such simple things as to take from where there is, without regard to established property principles or social philosophies, and to start to produce for themselves. Done on a broad social scale, it will lead to lasting results. On a local, isolated plane, it will be defeated. The bootleg miners have shown in a rather clear and impressive way that the so much bewailed absence of a socialist ideology on the part of the workers really does not prevent workers from acting quite anti-capitalistically, quite in accordance with their own needs. Breaking through the confines of private property in order to live up to their own necessities, the miners' action is, at the same time, a manifestation of the most important part of class consciousness, namely, that the problems of the workers can be solved only by themselves. Were the new dealers, Roosevelt and his advisors, the businessmen who supported him, also class conscious? Did they understand that measures must be quickly taken in 1933 and 1934 to give jobs, food baskets, relief, to wipe out the idea that the problems of the workers can be solved only by themselves? Perhaps, like the workers' class consciousness, it was a set of actions arising not from held theory, but from instinctive practical necessity. Perhaps it was such a consciousness that led to the Wagner-Connery Bill, introduced in Congress in early 1934, to regulate labor disputes. The bill provided elections for union representation, a board to settle problems and handle grievances. Was this not exactly the kind of legislation to do away with the idea that the problems of the workers can be solved only by themselves? Big business thought it was too helpful to labor and opposed it. Roosevelt was cool to it. But in the year 1934, a series of labor outbursts suggested the need for legislative action. 1.5 million workers in different industries went on strike in 1934. That spring and summer, longshoremen on the West Coast, in a rank-and-file insurrection against their own union leadership as well as against the shippers, held a convention, demanded the abolition of the shape-up, a kind of early morning slave market where work gangs were chosen for the day, and went out on strike. 2,000 miles of Pacific coastline were quickly tied up. The Teamsters cooperated, refusing to truck cargo to the piers, and maritime workers joined the strike. When the police moved in to open the piers, the strikers resisted en masse, and 2 were killed by police gunfire. A mass funeral procession for the strikers brought together tens of thousands of supporters. And then a general strike was called in San Francisco, with 130,000 workers out, the city immobilized. 500 special police were sworn in, and 4,500 National Guardsmen assembled, with infantry, machine gun, tank, and artillery units. The Los Angeles Times wrote, "The situation in San Francisco is not correctly described by the phrase general strike. What is actually in progress there is an insurrection, a communist-inspired and led revolt against organized government. There is but one thing to be done. Put down the revolt with any force necessary." The pressure became too strong. There were the troops. There was the AFL pushing to end the strike. The longshoremen accepted a compromise settlement, but they had shown the potential of a general strike. That same summer of 1934, a strike of Teamsters in Minneapolis was supported by other working people, and soon nothing was moving in the city except milk, ice, and coal trucks given exemptions by the strikers. Farmers drove their products into town and sold them directly to the people in the city. The police attacked, and 2 strikers were killed. 50,000 people attended a mass funeral. There was an enormous protest meeting and a march on City Hall. After a month, the employers gave in to the Teamsters' demands. In the fall of that same year, 1934, came the largest strike of all, 325,000 textile workers in the South. They left the mills and set up flying squadrons in trucks and autos to move through the strike areas, picketing, battling guards, entering the mills, unbelting machinery. Here, too, as in the other cases, the strike impetus came from the rank and file against a reluctant union leadership at the top. The New York Times said, "The grave danger of the situation is that it will get completely out of the hands of the leaders." Again, the machinery of the state was set in motion. Deputies and armed strikebreakers in South Carolina fired on pickets, killing 7, wounding 20 others. But the strike was spreading to New England. In Lowell, Massachusetts, 2,500 textile workers rioted. In Salesville, Rhode Island, a crowd of 5,000 people defied state troopers who were armed with machine guns and shut down the textile mill. In Woonsocket, Rhode Island, 2,000 people, aroused because someone had been shot and killed by the National Guard, stormed through the town and closed the mill. By September 18th, 421,000 textile workers were on strike throughout the country. There were mass arrests, organizers were beaten, and the death toll rose to 13. Roosevelt now stepped in and set up a board of mediation, and the union called off the strike. In the rural South, too, organizing took place, often stimulated by communists, but nourished by the grievances of poor whites and blacks who were tenant farmers or farm laborers, always in economic difficulties, but hit even harder by the Depression. The Southern Tenant Farmers Union started in Arkansas with black and white sharecroppers and spread to other areas. Roosevelt's AAA was not helping the poorest of farmers. In fact, by encouraging farmers to plant less, it forced tenants and sharecroppers to leave the land. By 1935, of 6,800,000 farmers, 2,800,000 were tenants. The average income of a sharecropper was $312 a year. Farm laborers, moving from farm to farm, area to area, no land of their own, in 1933, were earning about $300 a year. Black farmers were the worst off, and some were attracted to the strangers who began appearing in their area during the Depression, suggesting they organize. Nate Shaw recalls in Theodore Rosengarten's remarkable interview, "All God's Dangers." And during of the pressure years, a union began to operate in this country, called it the Sharecroppers Union. That was a nice name, I thought. And I knowed what was going on was a turnabout on the Southern man, white and colored. It was something unusual. And I heard about it being an organization for the poor class of people. Now, that's just what I wanted to get into, too. I wanted to know the secrets of it enough that I could become in the knowledge of it. Max Sloan, white man, said, "You stay out of it. These niggers running around here carrying on some kind of meeting. You better stay out of it." I said to myself, "You a fool if you think you can keep me from joining." I went right on and joined it, just as quick as the next meeting come. And he done just the thing to push me into it, give me orders not to join. The teachers of this organization begin to drive through this country, and they couldn't let what they was doing be known. One of them was a colored fella. I disremember his name, but he did a whole lot of time holding meetings with us. That was part of this job. Had the meetings at our houses or anywhere we could keep a look and a watch out that nobody was coming in on us. Small meetings sometimes. Sometimes there'd be a dozen. Niggas was scared. Niggas was scared. That's telling the truth. Nate Shaw told of what happened when a black farmer who hadn't paid his debts was about to be dispossessed. "Deputy said, 'I'm going to take all old Virgil Jones got this morning. I begged him not to do it, begged him. You'll dispossess him of being able to feed his family.'" Nate Shaw then told the deputy he was not going to allow it. The deputy came back with more men, and one of them shot and wounded Shaw, who then got his gun and fired back. He was arrested in late 1932 and served 12 years in an Alabama prison. His story is a tiny piece of the great unrecorded drama of the Southern poor in those years of the Sharecroppers Union. Years after his release from prison, Nate Shaw spoke his mind on color and class. "Oh, it's as plain as your hand. The poor white man and the poor black man is sitting in the same saddle today. Big dudes done branched him off that way. The control of a man, the control and power, is in the hands of the rich man. That class is standing together, and the poor white man is out there on the colored list. I've caught that. Ways and actions a heap of times speaks louder than words. Hosea Hudson, a black man from rural Georgia at the age of 10, a plowhand, later an iron worker in Birmingham, was aroused by the case of the Scottsboro Boys in 1931. 9 black youths accused of raping 2 white girls and convicted on flimsy evidence by all white juries. That year he joined the Communist Party. In 1932 and 1933, he organized unemployed blacks in Birmingham. He recalls, "Deep in the winter of 1932, we party members organized an unemployed mass meeting to be held on the old courthouse steps on 3rd Avenue, North Birmingham. It was about 7,000 or more people turned out, Negroes and whites. In 1932 and 33, we began to organize these unemployed block committees in the various communities of Birmingham. If someone get out of food, we wouldn't go around and just say, 'That's too bad.' We make it our business to go see this person, and if the person was willing, we'd work with them. Block committees would meet every week, had a regular meeting. We talked about the welfare question, what was happening. We read the Daily Worker and the Southern Worker to see what was going on about unemployed relief, what people doing in Cleveland, struggles in Chicago. Or we talk about the latest developments in the Scottsboro case. We kept up. We was on top. So people always wanted to come because we had something different to tell them every time." In 1934 and 1935, hundreds of thousands of workers left out of the tightly controlled, exclusive unions of the American Federation of Labor began organizing in the new mass production industries, auto, rubber, packing house. The AFL could not ignore them. It set up a committee for industrial organization to organize these workers outside of craft lines by industry, all workers in a plant belonging to one union. This committee, headed by John Lewis, then broke away and became the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations. But it was rank-and-file strikes and insurgencies that pushed the union leadership, AFL and CIO, into action. Jeremy Brecker tells the story in his book, Strike. A new kind of tactic began among rubber workers in Akron, Ohio, in the early 30s, the sit-down strike. The workers stayed put in the plant instead of walking out, and this had clear advantages. They were directly blocking the use of strikebreakers. They did not have to act through union officials, but were in direct control of the situation themselves. They did not have to walk outside in the cold and rain, but had shelter. They were not isolated as in their work or on the picket line. They were thousands under one roof, free to talk to one another, to form a community of struggle. Lewis Adamek, a labor writer, describes one of the early sit-downs. "Sitting by their machines, cauldrons, boilers, and workbenches, they talked. Some realized for the first time how important they were in the process of rubber production. 12 men had practically stopped the works. Superintendents, foremen, and straw bosses were dashing about. In less than an hour, the dispute was settled, full victory for the men." In early 1936, at the Firestone rubber plant in Akron, makers of truck tires, their wages already too low to pay for food and rent, were faced with a wage cut. When several union men were fired, others began to stop work, to sit down on the job. In one day, the whole of plant number 1 was sitting down. In 2 days, plant number 2 was sitting down, and management gave in. In the next 10 days, there was a sit-down at Goodyear. A court issued an injunction against mass picketing. It was ignored, and 150 deputies were sworn in. But they soon faced 10,000 workers from all over Akron. In a month, the strike was won. The idea spread through 1936. In December of that year began the longest sit-down strike of all, at Fisher Body Plant No. 1 in Flint, Michigan. It started when two brothers were fired, and it lasted until February 1937. For 40 days, there was a community of 2,000 strikers. It was like war, one said. The guys with me became my buddies. Sidney Fine in Sit Down describes what happened. Committees organized recreation, information, classes, a postal service, sanitation. Courts were set up to deal with those who didn't take their turn washing dishes or who threw rubbish or smoked where it was prohibited or brought in liquor. The punishment consisted of extra duties. The ultimate punishment was expulsion from the plant. A restaurant owner across the street prepared 3 meals a day for 2,000 strikers. There were classes in parliamentary procedure, public speaking, history of the labor movement. Graduate students at the University of Michigan gave courses in journalism and creative writing. There were injunctions, but a procession of 5,000 armed workers encircled the plant, and there was no attempt to enforce the injunction. Police attacked with tear gas, and the workers fought back with fire hoses. 13 strikers were wounded by gunfire, but the police were driven back. The governor called out the National Guard. By this time, the strike had spread to other General Motors plants. Finally, there was a settlement, a 6-month contract leaving many questions unsettled, but recognizing that from now on, the company would have to deal not with individuals, but with a union. In 1936, there were 48 sit-down strikes. In 1937, there were 477. Electrical workers in St. Louis, shirt workers in Pulaski, Tennessee, broom workers in Pueblo, Colorado, trash collectors in Bridgeport, Connecticut, grave diggers in New Jersey, 17 blind workers at the New York Guild for the Jewish Blind, prisoners in an Illinois penitentiary, and even 30 members of a National Guard company who had served in the Fisher body sit-down and now sat down themselves because they had not been paid. The sit-downs were especially dangerous to the system because they were not controlled by the regular union leadership. An AFL business agent for the hotel and restaurant employees said, "You'd be sitting in the office any March day of 1937, and the phone would ring and the voice at the other end would say, 'My name is Mary Jones. I'm a soda clerk at Liggett's. We've thrown the manager out and we've got the keys. What do we do now?' And you'd hurry over to the company to negotiate, and over there they'd say, 'I think it's the height of irresponsibility to call a strike before you've ever asked for a contract.' And all you could answer was, 'You're so right.'" It was to stabilize the system in the face of labor unrest that the Wagner Act of 1935, setting up a National Labor Relations Board, had been passed. The wave of strikes in 1936, 1937, 1938 made the need even more pressing. In Chicago on Memorial Day 1937, a strike at Republic Steel brought the police out, firing at a mass picket line of strikers, killing 10 of them. Autopsies showed the bullets had hit the workers in the back as they were running away. This was the Memorial Day massacre. But Republic Steel was organized, and so was Ford Motor Company, and the other huge plants in steel, auto, rubber, meatpacking, the electrical industry. The Wagner Act was challenged by a steel corporation in the courts, but the Supreme Court found it constitutional, that the government could regulate interstate commerce, and that strikes hurt interstate commerce. From the trade union's point of view, the new law was an aid to union organizing. From the government's point of view, it was an aid to the stability of commerce. Unions were not wanted by employers, but they were more controllable, more stabilizing for the system than the wildcat strikes, the factory occupations of the rank and file. In the spring of 1937, a New York Times article carried the headline, "Unauthorized sit-downs fought by CIO unions." The story read, "Strict orders have been issued to all organizers and representatives that they will be dismissed if they authorize any stoppages of work without the consent of the international officers." The Times quoted John L. Lewis, dynamic leader of the CIO. A CIO contract is adequate protection against sit-downs, lie-downs, or any other kind of strike. The Communist Party, some of whose members played critical roles in organizing CIO unions, seemed to take the same position. One communist leader in Akron was reported to have said at a party strategy meeting after the sit-downs, "Now we must work for regular relations between the union and the employers, and strict observance of union procedure on the part of the workers." Thus, two sophisticated ways of controlling direct labor action developed in the mid-30s. First, the National Labor Relations Board would give unions legal status, listen to them, settling certain of their grievances. Thus, it could moderate labor rebellion by channeling energy into elections, just as the constitutional system channeled possibly troublesome energy into voting. The NLRB would set limits in economic conflict as voting did in political conflict. And second, the workers' organization itself, the union, even a militant and aggressive union like the CIO, would channel the workers' insurrectionary energy into contracts, negotiations, union meetings, and try to minimize strikes in order to build large, influential, even respectable organizations. The history of those years seems to support the argument of Richard Cloward and Francis Piven in their book, Poor People's Movements, that labor won most during its spontaneous uprisings, before the unions were recognized or well-organized. Factory workers had their greatest influence and were able to exact their most substantial concessions from government during the Great Depression, in the years before they were organized into unions. Their power during the Depression was not rooted in organization, but in disruption. Piven and Cloward point out that union membership rose enormously in the 40s, during the Second World War. The CIO and AFL had over 6 million members each by 1945. But its power was less than before. Its gains from the use of strikes kept getting whittled down. The members appointed to the NLRB were less sympathetic to labor. The Supreme Court declared sit-downs to be illegal, and state governments were passing laws to hamper strikes, picketing, boycotts. The coming of World War II weakened the old labor militancy of the 30s, because the war economy created millions of new jobs at higher wages. The New Deal had succeeded only in reducing unemployment from 13 million to 9 million. It was the war that put almost everyone to work, and the war did something else. Patriotism, the push for unity of all classes against enemies overseas, made it harder to mobilize anger against the corporations. During the war, the CIO and AFL pledged to call no strikes. Still, the grievances of workers were such, wartime controls meant their wages were being controlled better than prices, that they felt impelled to engage in many wildcat strikes. There were more strikes in 1944 than in any previous year in American history, says Jeremy Brecker. The 30s and 40s showed more clearly than before the dilemma of working people in the United States. The system responded to workers' rebellions by finding new forms of control, internal control by their own organizations as well as outside control by law and force. But along with the new controls came new concessions. These concessions didn't solve basic problems. For many people, they solved nothing. But they helped enough people to create an atmosphere of progress and improvement to restore some faith in the system. The minimum wage of 1938, which established the 40-hour week and outlawed child labor, left many people out of its provisions and set very low minimum wages, 25 cents an hour the first year. But it was enough to dull the edge of resentment. Housing was built for only a small percentage of the people who needed it. A modest, even parsimonious beginning, Paul Konkin says, FDR and the Origins of the Welfare State. But the sight of federally subsidized housing projects, playgrounds, vermin-free apartments, replacing dilapidated tenements was refreshing. The TVA suggested exciting possibilities for regional planning to give jobs, improve areas, and provide cheap power with local instead of national control. The Social Security Act gave retirement benefits and unemployment insurance and matched state funds for mothers and dependent children. But it excluded farmers, domestic workers, and old people and offered no health insurance. As Konkin says, the meager benefits of Social Security were insignificant in comparison to the building of security for large established businesses. The New Deal gave federal money to put thousands of writers, artists, actors, and musicians to work in a federal theater project, a federal writers project, a federal art project. Murals were painted on public buildings. Plays were put on for working-class audiences who had never seen a play. Hundreds of books and pamphlets were written and published. People heard a symphony for the first time. It was an exciting flowering of arts for the people, such as never happened before in American history, and which has not been duplicated since. But in 1939, with the country more stable and the New Deal reform impulse weakened, programs to subsidize the arts were eliminated. When the New Deal was over, capitalism remained intact. The rich still controlled the nation's wealth, as well as its laws, courts, police, newspapers, churches, colleges. Enough help had been given to enough people to make Roosevelt a hero to millions. But the same system that had brought depression and crisis, the system of waste, of inequality, of concern for profit over human need, remained. For black people, the New Deal was psychologically encouraging. Mrs. Roosevelt was sympathetic. Some blacks got posts in the administration. But most blacks were ignored by the New Deal programs. As tenant farmers, as farm laborers, as migrants, as domestic workers, they didn't qualify for unemployment insurance, minimum wages, Social Security, or farm subsidies. Roosevelt, careful not to offend Southern white politicians whose political support he needed, did not push a bill against lynching. Blacks and whites were segregated in the armed forces, and black workers were discriminated against in getting jobs. They were the last hired, the first fired. Only when A. Philip Randolph, head of the Sleeping Car Porters Union, threatened a massive march on Washington in 1941, would Roosevelt agree to sign an executive order establishing a Fair Employment Practices Committee. But the FEPC had no enforcement powers and changed little. Black Harlem, with all the New Deal reforms, remained as it was. There, 350,000 people lived, 233 persons per acre, compared with 133 for the rest of Manhattan. In 25 years, its population had multiplied 6 times. 10,000 families lived in rat-infested cellars and basements. Tuberculosis was common. Perhaps half of the married women worked as domestics. They traveled to the Bronx and gathered on street corners, slave markets they were called, to be hired. Prostitution crept in. 2 young black women, Ella Baker and Marvel Cook, wrote about this in The Crisis in 1935. Not only is human labor bartered and sold for the slave wage, but human love is also a marketable commodity. Whether it is labor or love, the women arrive as early as 8 a.m. and remain as late as 1 p.m. or until they are hired. In rain or shine, hot or cold, they wait to work for 10, 15, and 20 cents per hour. In Harlem Hospital in 1932, proportionately, twice as many people died as in Bellevue Hospital, which was in the white area downtown. Harlem was a place that bred crime, the bitter blossom of poverty, as Roy Otley and William Weatherby say in their essay, The Negro in New York. On March 19, 1935, even as the New Deal reforms were being passed, Harlem exploded. 10,000 Negroes swept through the streets, destroying the property of white merchants. 700 policemen moved in and brought order. 2 blacks were killed. In the mid-30s, a young black poet named Langston Hughes wrote a poem, "Let America Be America Again." I am the poor white, fooled and pushed apart. I am the Negro bearing slavery's scars. I am the red man driven from